So I'm going to be talking about some issues that arise when we try to think about psychology across cultures. And just by way of background, so I got interested in the questions I'm going to be talking about today a few years ago. So I was asked to contribute to a project on Croatian psychopaths. So this was a project funded by the Croatian government, trying to figure out what to do with Croatian psychopaths. And the basic way that they thought of the project was that the aim was to kind of translate psychopathy policy as it developed in the United States into the Croatian context. And so for them to get this to work, what they needed to do was they needed to be able to take empirical studies, mainly done in the United States in the 1990s, say, and to use them to say something about what could be expected to happen in Croatia. And so I guess what I'm going to be talking about today is the question of whether we should expect those kinds of inductive generalisations to work. So I said the question is psychopathy an inductively projectable kind? So what I mean by that is there are certain kinds, so things like chemical elements, where if you do experiments to find out the properties of aluminium in the United States a few decades ago, you'd expect that to also be true in Croatia. But the question is, well, is evidence to do with psychopathy, is it going to be generalisable in that kind of way? Now, I think in all the talks, people have been talking about some of the conceptual lack of clarity that there is when people are talking about psychopathy. So one of the big problems when you look at empirical evidence claims that are made about psychopathy is it's very often unclear exactly what it is that people are talking about. And particularly, it can be unclear what the relationship's supposed to be between psychopathy and various related concepts, so antisocial personality disorder. So antisocial personality disorder is a condition defined in the DSM. So the DSM is the classification of mental disorders. It's developed by the American Psychiatric Association. For each condition, there's a list of diagnostic criteria. So it's kind of tick list. So like if you've got the things on the list, then that's what it is for you to have that condition. Antisocial personality disorder, as it's defined in the DSM, is characterized, I said, in terms of bad actions. So there's a list of things you don't want to do, really. And if you do enough of them, and you do them regularly enough, and you've done them since you're a kid, then you're going to meet the diagnostic criteria. So it's free from a list of seven, and they're to do with criminality, with deceiving people, with being impulsive, being aggressive, starting fights, having a reckless disregard for safety. Consistent irresponsibility, which the DSM spells out as having to do with whether you fail to turn up to work, and lack of awareness. But it's a precisely defined concept. So that's what antisocial personality disorder is. It's defined like that by the DSM. And then people also talk about psychopathy. So Martin Pickersgill is a sociologist. He's a sociologist looking at psychiatry. He's got a very interesting paper where he looks at how the terms antisocial personality disorder and psychopathy were used in UK policy documents, and he also spoke to some experts in the area to try to find out how they thought of the relationship between psychopathy and antisocial personality disorder. And what he found is that people just use the terms in different ways. And so sometimes the words get used as if they're completely interchangeable. Sometimes people talk about psychopathy as if it was a particularly severe form of antisocial personality disorder. Sometimes psychopathy can be thought of as a character type, which is such that the individual might or might not engage in antisocial or immoral activities. So sometimes psychopathy is thought of as being a character type where people kind of crave excitement, they're quite callous, they're not going to feel guilt, but
where if they find an appropriate ecological niche, which might be, so being a brain surgeon, you know, can be useful to kind of chop people up and not try too much if it goes wrong. So if you find the right kind of environmental niche, you might be able to do anything particularly terrible against tropical law. So there's that conception. And then sometimes when people talk about psychopathy, they mean a construct defined by this particular diagnostic checklist, which we're going to be talking about a bit more, which has been discussed a bit already. So the PCLR is a checklist. And sometimes when people talk about psychopathy, they mean somebody who scores over 30 on that. And we'll look at that in a second, but it's an interesting mashup in that you get scores for various items on the list. Some of them look like they're descriptions of character traits, some of them have to do with types of activity that you might have engaged in. So there's a lot of confusion. There's at least two distinct concepts kind of hanging around. So on the one hand, there's a kind of person who does various types of bad things. So the diagnostic criteria for antisocial personality disorder, you can get that diagnosis if you've got a long history of starting fights, being deceptive, not holding down a job, getting into trouble with the law. Those are all types of activity. On the other hand, there's a concept which is of a particular character type, and these, I think, are clearly distinct concepts. So I've already mentioned, you know, you can imagine being a character type psychopath, but being lucky, you get yourself a nice job as a brain surgeon, or you join the SAS or whatever, and you never get into any bother. So that would be a character type psychopath who never actually gets into any trouble. I think you can also imagine people with average characters where, because of the particular environment which they find themselves, they can get a diagnosis of antisocial personality disorder even though their character is quite standard. You know? So it's like, I think you can imagine situations in which, you know, you grow up in a really violent, gang-ridden environment, you start fighting, maybe to defend yourself, maybe preemptively, you go around nicking stuff, you get into lots of trouble, and you can end up with an antisocial personality sort of diagnosis even though, you know, your underlying character is the same as it is when you're sitting in the room. So there's these distinct concepts, and then there's going to be an overlapping area. So one of the problems with trying to kind of translate empirical findings about psychopathy from one concept to another is very often it's kind of unclear exactly what it is that people are talking about. And then obviously there's also big kind of sulking issues, as has been mentioned already. So most of the studies are done with psychopaths who've ended up in prison. and they might not be characteristic of the kind of people who don't end up in prison. Now, when it comes to research on psychopathy, a lot of it depends on the use of the PCLR, which is the psychopathy checklist revised. So this is a checklist that was originally developed in the 1970s. It has been revised a few times since then. It's developed on male white US prisons. And the way it works is there's 20 items on a scale, on the list. Yeah, and if you really show an item, you get 2. If it's not around 2, you're talking, you get 0, and these scores are rounded up. It gets scored on the basis of an interview and on a review of whatever paperwork, so your criminal record or whatever it might be. Now, the things on the list, so we've seen some already. So these are the items you get scored for. Some of them seem to have to do with character traits, so like grandiose sense of self-worth. Some of them are types of activity, promiscuous sexual behaviour. Some of them get scored kind of qualitatively. So from the instructions in the manual, item 3 is to do with a need for stimulation and proneness to boredom. So that gets scored on the basis of the interview, and the people who do the interviews, they're trained to, so that they can end up being fairly reliable. You know, it doesn't matter too much who it is who does the interview. But in the instructions, this is for an individual who demonstrates a chronic and excessive need
for novel and exciting stimulation, and an unusual proneness to boredom. You will usually express a strong interest in taking chances, living life in the fast lane or on the edge, being where the action is, and in doing things that are exciting, risky, or challenging. So it says he here, so most people who get diagnosed with psychopathy, so I'm going to be using he throughout this talk as well. So this is scored kind of qualitatively. There are other items where it's more quantitative. So you get a score for having had many short-term marital relationships. And you don't have to have been formally married, but it's kind of like a living relationship, you get any points on this. And here it's quite precisely defined. You know, like if you've had three or more and you're under 20, under 30, then you score two. Now, in the population where it's developed, PCLR scores are reliable. What I mean by that is that if one person gets rated by two trained interviewers independently, the scores are likely to be pretty close. And it can predict the chances that someone's going to be rehabilitated, the chances that they're going to re-offend. And the question is, well, what's going on with the PCLR? So it's this list of items, and I take it that the idea is that these items are supposed to be indicators of some kind of underlying tendency to behave in a particular way. So I take it that they're supposed to be indicators of some underlying character, you know, which has to do with taking risks, potentially being aggressive and so on and so forth. So the question is, well, will this work elsewhere or in other times? I'm going to talk about two worries. So one has to do with looping and one has to do with problems that I think arise when intentional actions get used in diagnostic checking. So first of all, for looping, so Ian Hacking is the philosopher who's written most about the ways in which there can be a feedback between descriptions of what he calls humankinds and how people behave. So humankinds are kinds of people as studied in the human sciences. So psychopath is going to be a humankind. And you get looping effects because there's a bunch of people in the world. They get studied and described by scientists, but the scientists don't keep their ideas all to themselves. And they go around writing books, and then that gets picked up by the lay culture. The people described come to know how they're being described and alter their behaviour. So the descriptions end up making a difference to the behaviour that gets manifested, and then the descriptions have to be revised. So there's a kind of arms war between descriptions and shifts in the way that people behave. Now, my favourite example of this is this book. So this is a book. So the PCLR is really important in particular settings. So particularly in various states in the United States, if you get into trouble, you might find yourself having to try and pass the PCLR. If you get counted as a psychopath, it will make a difference to how you're treated. So the idea with psychopaths is that they're particularly unlikely to be rehabilitated. And so if you get counted as a psychopath, you can find yourself in a different section of the justice system, and one where you're a lot less likely to be released in time too. So people who know that they might need to pass this test are motivated to find out what the answers are. And you can buy this book on Amazon. And it's a very interesting book. My copy's gone missing. I like to think that one of my colleagues has come into my office and nicked it, but that might not be the case. But if you get into trouble, this is the book you need. And what it does is it tells you exactly what questions you're going to be asked and how your responses are going to be rated. So it tells you what you need to say. And it goes into a great deal of detail. So it tells you like how often to look at the interviewer, when to fidget, when not to be too quick to respond, and so on and so forth. So that's a very clear example of a looping effect. you know. So people who might be diagnosed as psychopaths find out about the test and revise for it, which is going to make a difference to the ratings that they receive. There are also more subtle effects. So for quite a long time I've been interested in the ways in which people who receive psychiatric diagnoses respond to those diagnoses. And I've been particularly interested in how people diagnosed with antisocial personality disorders, that's the DSM diagnosis, how people who get that diagnosis respond to having it. I think it's a particularly interesting case because if you get diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder, essentially it means you're a bad person. And personality disorders are traditionally thought of as being deep-seated and quite resistant to treatment. So if you're diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder, it means that you're a bad person and you're not going to get any better. And so I was interested in how people responded when they got that diagnosis. And so some years ago, 2008, I found a support group online, a group of antisocial personality disorder, and had a look at what they said. When I looked then, there seemed to be three different types of response. More recently, there's an additional way to respond to these kind of diagnostic labels that has developed. So one of the things that I think is interesting is that the ways in which people respond to diagnostic labels, but it's like there are some ways that are culturally salient at different times, and new ways of responding to diagnostic labels can come into being and then become more accessible to people within that community. But in 2008, there were some people who refused to accept their diagnosis. So there'd be people who'd say, I've been told I've got antisocial personality disorder, but I don't believe it. And that's something that it's not an entirely implausible way for someone to respond. So either they can say, I don't believe it because the person who diagnosed me is incompetent in some way. Or they can say, but of course everyone knows the DSM is a load of rubbish, you know, which is not a wholly plausible thing to say. So that's one option. The first option is to say, I've got this diagnosis, but it doesn't mean anything. It's nonsense. There were also people who went for it. Yeah? So there are some people where when they get diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder, they say, yep, I'm bad. I'm really, really bad. And they kind of try and out-bad each other, right? So there are people online who'd adopt names like Murder for Hire and would swap stories about how they were the first to start torturing kids and animals and stuff. And then, like, some of them go on about Nietzsche. I think reading Nietzsche too much should take you to be a clear sign of having unhealthy interests. So that's one way of responding. I think that way of responding is interesting because it's plausible that if you decide to go for it and show how really, really bad you are, then that's like to make you a worse person. So it's you know, if you end up kind of delighting in your label of being a having antisocial personality disorder, you're likely to behave in worse ways than you would have done otherwise. There was a third kind of response, which was quite sad. So there were some people who got a diagnosis, they believed it, and they didn't know what to do about it. So there was a post headed hopeless after diagnosis. So one of the problems with personality disorders is, as I said, they're traditionally thought to be highly resistant to treatment. And so what that means is that there are people who find themselves being diagnosed with personality disorder, and essentially they're kind of told, oh, you've got this personality disorder, you know, there's nothing we can do, good luck. And don't know what to do. Now, when I looked more recently, there's a newer response which wasn't there in 2008, or at least it wasn't the same, it wasn't like you could type it to Google and it would come up very soon as well.
So this is a book, this is a kind of self-help guide. It's not explicitly directed at psychopaths. But it's an interesting book. So it's written by this guy, Andy McNabb, who's had a successful career in the SAS, and who scores quite highly on the PCR test. And this is his like life skills book. And so it's become culturally salient that there's this possibility that you might be diagnosed as a psychopath or as a social personality disorder, and that if you can find the right social niche, that might not be a problem. You might still have a flourishing life and not causing you any problems. If you go online, so there are quite a lot of army units where they try hard to screen out people who might be psychopaths, but there are persistent rumours that the French Foreign Legion is more welcoming or less fussy. And so there is this idea now that the thing to do if you get diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder is to go and find yourself an appropriate job, yeah? Which might be like the French Foreign Legion if you can't become a brain surgeon or a businessman. And so the thought is that how people are going to behave if they get diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder or psychopathy is going to be shaped by the cultural discourse that's around. Yeah? So you get this label, you say, well, what's that mean? You look it up on Google, and you find various options, various ways of understanding yourself. And these culturally salient narratives are historically shifting. Like new ones can come into being, and then they provide pathways, ways that people can think about themselves. And this is going to make a difference to how people behave. So looping is the first phenomenon I want to discuss that I think occurs in the case of antisocial personality disorder and psychopathy, and should lead us to think that it's unlikely that psychopathy will be a robustly, inductively projectable colour. Because what someone's going to be like depends on how they think about themselves, and those kinds of cultural narratives are kind of shifting and vary from place to place and time to time. Now, the other concern I have has to do with the role that intentional actions are playing in the diagnosis of psychopathy. So intentional actions are a subset of all human behaviours. So they're things that people do for reasons. You think of reasons being made up of a belief or a desire. So to give you a standard kind of example, let's suppose I put a pizza in the oven. I can explain what I'm doing. I can say, well, I want some tea, and I believe that pizza should be cooked practically. So that's the reason why I'm doing that. So that's a standard kind of example of an intentional action. You can also get slightly non-standard cases. So there might be cases where the belief and the desire just gets left unstated. It's too obvious who it is. So you say to the bank robber, why did you rob the bank? And they will say, well, that's where the money is. So non-standard cases where the belief or desire might just be wrong or weird. So somebody tries to kill themselves. So why did you do that? It's like, oh, I'm the worst person in the world. Presume that's nonsense. It still counts as a reasonable as an intentional action. So in contrast to intentional actions with mere behaviours, things like sneezing, fitting, slipping, and in these cases, if you ask someone why it is that they've done that, they won't be able to give an explanation in terms of reasons. They might not have any idea why they've done it, so somebody might not know why they've fitted. Or they might offer an explanation in terms of causes. Now, intentional actions pop up a lot in the PCLR. So on the items of the list, these are just some of the intentional actions, there's more. Yeah? So things like engaging in sexual activity is going to be intentional actions. Setting out to deceive someone, starting fights, lying, theft, robbery. So these are all intentional actions. I want to take an idea from Alistair McIntyre's work. The idea that I want to take is that when we're trying to make sense with intentional actions. We have to employ a kind of narrative framework. And these are going to be culturally specific. And so what this means is that kind of thinly described actions, like starting fights, or at lunchroom talking about carrying guns, what that means is just going to vary quite radically depending on the cultural setting. So in the UK, if I tell you that I've carried a gun, you know, going to the pub, you'd be like, oh my God, that's really, really bad. What kind of crazy person am I? Whereas in the States, apparently completely normal people just, you know, it's like, that's what you do. And so depending on the cultural framework, what it means to act in that way is entirely different. And the kind of person who's going to engage in that activity varies radically as well.
So the thought is that we need, I don't know what you're going to call it, a narrative. So narrative gets used a lot, and sometimes it's a term which has kind of overly heavy-weighted connotations. But we need like a narrative frame or a script or a schema in order to make action character links. What I mean by that is that when someone acts in a particular way, we want to understand what it is they're doing and what kind of person they're likely to be, then we need to have this kind of narrative framework in the back of our minds. And these are going to be culture and gender specific. So just to give you an example, let's think about truancy and what it means for a kid to play truant. So truancy appears on the PCLR kind of indirectly in the characters from juvenile delinquency that you get school. If you think about what it means for a kid to play truant in our culture, if you want to get a job, you probably need to have some qualifications, your parents probably want to get you straight to school. And so if you're truant, you're probably a bit naughty and quite reckless. But in other settings, that hasn't been the case. So in the 1960s, there was full employment. People didn't need to have school qualifications, really. And so lots of kids, even though they were legally supposed to be at school, would just stop going because they've got a job. And in that setting, if a kid is truant, it's a different kind of kid. There's no reason to think they're being naughty or reckless. Like, they're ignoring the law, but that doesn't really matter. Or to take another example, there was a campaign in some part of the States where they were trying to get religious parents to keep their kid out of school as a kind of protest against kids being told about gay people or something shocking like that in school. So there again, you've got a very different kind of child who's being truant. So the meaning of truancy is unstable across culture. What it tells you about the kind of people who might be involved in it just varies. Give some other cases. So I was interested in Croatia. I found a study where 97% of Croatian medical students admitted to cheating in their exams. Which is pretty high. and I think it suggests the cultural understanding of what it is to cheating in an exam is somewhat different in Croatia than it would be. If you think about promiscuous sex, in some cultures, promiscuous sex is thought of as being fine, as long as it's kind of consensual, it's just like whatever. In other cultures, it's frowned upon, and the kind of person who's going to engage in that kind of activity is going to vary between those kinds of settings. So, I guess the question is, well, this is all kind of very nice, but you might not even think that. But this is a kind of philosophical kind of argument. So I've suggested that what intentional actions are going to tell you about the kind of person that's going to like to be engaged in activity is going to be unstable across cultures, and that's likely to cause problems with interpreting what PCLR schools mean across cultures. Now, is there any evidence that this actually causes any problems? Well, I think it should do.
So on the PCLR, remember it was a total score of 40 points. Two of the items on the list have to do more or less directly with attitudes towards sex. So you get a score for promiscuous sex, you can also get a score for having many of the short-term marital relationships. So I think depending on the attitudes towards sex in the culture in which you're living, that can make a difference of up to 4, which is quite significant when the cut-off point is around 30. And lots of people in criminal settings, who, at least those who've been convicted of bad stuff, they will be getting pretty close to that kind of threshold anyway.
So I think that could be expected to make a difference. I was looking for empirical studies where there did seem to be issues with the PCLR scores that have to do with social actions. The most direct I could find is an MSc thesis, so I guess it's not that good. But it's looking at the application of the PCLR in the Democratic Republic of Congo, and the author notes that there are some scores on the PCLR where the score that someone's getting for the individual item doesn't seem to correlate well with the overall score. So it looks like there are some items that are behaving kind of wrongly. And they comment that some of the ones that don't seem to correlate well, one is parasitism. So on the PCLR, parasitism is like living off other people. So like basically not being financially independent and getting money off other people. They comment that in the Democratic Republic of Congo, parasitism is not a socially deviant behaviour, as each person is defined in relation to the community. The individual lives in mutual support within their community. This constitutes a positive value and not a type of social deviance. And then they also comment on how having short-term marital relationships can be given in context. So, I want to suggest that diagnostic tools like the PCLR
that employ intentional actions and are trying to score something more underlying. So I say character type, but some underlying disposition, some reason to think that it kind of means something. I think they can't be expected to be reliable cross-culturally. And so you might think, right, okay, so what you need to do if you want to use one of these diagnostic checklists in a different culture is that the checklist needs to be made culture specific. So you'd have to have like a Croatian specific one where deception in certain contexts isn't such a big deal. So. But the problem is that loads of work has to go into making these kinds of diagnostic checklists. Reliable. So it takes years and years for these to be made reliable. They have to be developed using quite large populations. And so like actually getting culture-specific versions is practically a nightmare undertaking, particularly because one of the things about this Croatian project is they have actually found any psychopaths in Croatia. technically, even if you could find your psychopath, developing a culture-specific kind of diagnostic checklist is a major undertaking.
So, to summarise, I was interested in the question, how likely is it that a kind of antisocial personality disorder or psychopathy can be expected to be an inductively projective kind? And I've discussed some grounds for pessimism. And so these are kinds where it looks like you're going to have looping effects, so the behaviours of people are going to be affected by the descriptions that come within their particular culture. And I think the use of intentional actions and these diagnostic checklists is likely to cause problems. And that's it.
Thank you.